Welcome to the Human Factors and Ergonomics Hub, a series of educational podcasts that showcase the connection between human capabilities and good work design. Brought to you by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia. Hi, I'm Sharon Todd, and in this podcast, I'm talking to Dr. Patrick Newman, one of the keynote speakers at the HFESA conference this coming November. Dr. Patrick Newman is a design scientist, a certified human factors professional, and he is the head of the Human Factors Engineering Lab in Toronto Metropolitan University's Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering, where he is a full professor. He has published over 270 conference and scientific journal publications in the area of human factors in work system design. Dr. Newman's work has been recognised internationally with best paper awards in the biomedical, industrial engineering and ergonomics literatures. So Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about human factors and ergonomics and what you're doing in your work. I wanted to ask initially, how did you become interested in human factors and ergonomics?
Well, firstly, thanks for having me. Very happy to have this chat. I first got wind that something like ergonomics existed in my undergraduate education in the kinesiology program, which I'm not sure if you have kinesiology as a discipline there. Sometimes it's called sports science. I found it quite interesting. It covers all aspects of really of human functioning. So it's multidisciplinary. You have physiology, anatomy, biomechanics, but also sociology, and there are some clinical aspects as well. And in our particular school, I was at the University of Waterloo. They had a specialty in this area of ergonomics, which was injury prevention. And just because of my nature, I was really interested, as much more interested in prevention than in treatment, being a clinical kinesiologist. And so I started doing work terms in the co-op program that were oriented at doing ergonomics in manufacturing facilities. And from there, I became more and more interested in the discipline and sort of realized that, well, we had a lot of knowledge around how people function and how people, you know, the biomechanics of the body and the physiology. We didn't really have a lot of knowledge, and there wasn't much training on how to get ergonomics done, right? What are you doing when you do ergonomics? And our early experiences were, you know, we'd go out and we'd say, we'd use some lifting tool or a biomechanics model and find that the problem was actually getting the change to happen. Right. And that it was just so difficult to get anything to happen on the shop floor, even though the actual ergonomics analysis was perhaps a few hours of work. Right. And the rest of it was trying to make things happen. So that sort of spurred my interest in the idea of how you get ergonomics done, and gradually started to realize that you need to focus on the design. You need to try to get up front to get things designed right the first time. And so that sort of launched my interest in ergonomics, but also sort of led to the research program that that I'm now pursuing, as trying to understand how should we be doing ergonomics. And I think it's a question we have some answers for, but I think we still need to do better. But that's sort of how I got into the program, through the kinesiology route, and then realizing that it was not a health problem, not a medical problem. That was an engineering, a design problem, and that sort of shaped my career from there.
So you've been a clinician. What are you doing currently?
I'll just correct that. I've not been a clinician. I don't do treatment. You know, it's about, call it a personality defect. I don't like sick people. I want to really help people stay healthy. And so that's what I've been working on. So I'm a researcher now. I'm a professor in the industrial engineering group here at the Toronto Metropolitan University. And a lot of my focus is on the organization of design and how you help designers to think about the human at the point that they're making critical design decisions. And there the idea is that that problem of making a change on the shop floor goes away if you can design it right the first time. And the expenses of having to retrofit and throw out equipment and interrupt production or interrupt caregiving tasks vanishes if you can design things right the first time. And so for me, that's kind of the ideal, the North Star, if you will, as I try to see, like, what does it take to make that happen? And what knowledge do we need? Who needs to do what? What are the organizational drivers of good design? And all of those are elements that help me formulate specific projects as I sort of ladder my way up through the design process from the shop floor up to initial concept stages.
So how do you source the work that you're working on? Do people come to you or do you go to them?
Mostly it's me going to them. You know, I think one of the accusations that's been leveled about my work is I tend to be in front of the curve. So the things that I'm focusing on are often things that people aren't asking for yet, right? But if we start to wonder, how can we understand, for example, for nurses, how can we understand nurse workload in the face of changing patient demands or the new requirements for infection control during a pandemic? There are no tools right now that help with that. And the healthcare system has no tools to understand it. Same thing with manufacturing. When we look at a manufacturing company, they have no indicators for ergonomics or human factors other than injury rates. And that's it. But for the design team, there's no requirements, there's no indicators, there's no tools to check. And so that spawns us to start looking at, well, what if we created a tool here? What if we worked with a design team there in order to see, just how does your process evolve? Where are the critical decisions? And how could we give you a simple tool that would just let you check the most basic things, right? So you can very quickly ensure that you have high quality production, but don't overload your people. And so the concept usually comes from us, and then we go find a partner and try to sell them on the idea. And that seems to be the process. Our projects tend to be very big. Most of my projects take 5 to 10 years to set up, to get the funding, to get the project done, and then to start sharing the results. So all of these projects are very big steps and very big investments of time and resources.
So let's chat about some of those projects. What are you working on, or what have you been working on at the moment?
So one of the hot ones that we've been doing right now is trying to look at using simulation tools to understand nursing work and now also personal support care worker work in healthcare settings. So we started in hospitals. We've known for a long time that work overload is a problem in nursing. I don't know what the situation is for you in Australia right now, but we have a desperate nurse shortage. And while we're trying to run out to the developing nations and basically lure all of their staff away to come work for us, it's not going to solve the problem if we're still burning out nurses from overwork, right? And we're seeing from our nursing school, some nurses' careers can be measured in as little as weeks before they say, this is not my job, this is not what I want to do, I'm gone. And so the entire investment of training is lost. And so what we're trying to do is understand nursing work and the variability of nursing work using classical engineering simulation tools like discrete event simulation. And these things can give us a task-by-task analysis of how a workday might unfold. And the tools are really, really good at handling variability so that the various times it might take for someone to complete a task. If you have a more acute patient, it's going to take you longer. A less acute patient, it'll be faster. We can put all of this into the model. And we work with nurses to understand the logic of how they assemble their day. We work with them to understand how long and with how much variability tasks take. And we kind of pile all of that into these simulations. And what that lets us do then is simulate an entire nursing shift under very specific conditions in a matter of seconds. And so if we want to understand what's causing the workload, why do nurses have 14 hours of work to do in a 12-hour shift, these tools can help us unravel that. And we're getting tremendous pickup on this from a series of projects we've done, starting with a sort of if you build it, they will come kind of hope and getting tremendous pickup. So management realizes and leadership realizes, the unions realize they don't have a measure of workload beyond something like nurse-patient ratio. But which patients, how acute, where are they located, what's the current situation in the unit? All of those things, of course, drive what the actual workload of the person is. And so we're trying to use these models to expose that in a way that lets you understand why and what aspects of nursing work are leading to, for example, missed care at the end of a shift that has to get passed on or done in overtime work or in some other way handled, right? And the tool then lets you isolate and sort of turn the dial on each element of the layout, right? What if the beds are all close together? What if the beds are all spread apart? What if the med room for getting medications was located somewhere else, right? All of these things can then really quickly and easily be tested to explore what's the impact on workload and how do we arrange to get a reasonable 12 hours of work in a 12-hour shift, not the 14 hours of work that we were seeing in acute care settings at the start of the project. So people are very, very interested in this. I think it's really early days for these models, but they're showing a lot of promise. And so we're very interested in trying to roll that out now to long-term care in the future. So that's a long-winded answer, but there's an entire sort of research agenda there that we're driving on how can we stimulate these in ways that let us plan and design better systems for the future.
So I assume that you are talking digital monitoring?
Yeah. So, okay. The simulations themselves are their computer-based simulations in which we have a simulant nurse who will move through the geography of what we've programmed into the system. So we start with the layout of the unit, where the rooms are, where the beds are. We start with actual lists of care task frequencies that are recorded. And we add in the nurse's logic, how they decide where to move. And we add in the timing that we usually have to measure and the distribution and variability of those. And those things then are sort of piled into what's essentially an off-the-shelf simulation tools. They were traditionally used for manufacturing, right? Your car starts at station one, it's there for a minute plus or minus, then it goes to station two, then it moves on. And so you look at the movement of the car through the factory. And they've been used a lot in healthcare for the movement of the patient, right? How many patients in the waiting room? How long do they sit there? When do they move to the doctor's office and on from there? And what we've done is turned that on its side to look at how the nurse moves or how the caregiver moves through their workspace to do the tasks that they need to do. And so that's the nature of the simulation. And if you turn on the graphics, you can see a little figure of a nurse moving through the system use that actually to understand what that work pattern is that's programmed in.
So there would be a lot of data that you would need to put into this system, such as the biomechanical data, as well as hierarchical task analysis. And
yeah, so I mean, it's a layered problem, right, in modeling. You have to start with something simple. You can't boil the ocean, as they say, right? So you start with a very simple model of what are the tasks, what are the task times, how often do those tasks occur for any given patient, and what's the variability on those? The variability is a really big aspect, right? The layout we measure and the logic we get from focus groups with the nurses. So those are sort of the core elements of a base model. Biomechanics we've started adding as a layer that we add on top. So when you're doing a given task, we can go and do biomechanical analyses with a conventional digital human model. We use WAPBAC, but it doesn't really matter what you use. Most of my solutions, I try to avoid being software specific, right? It's about the nature of the approach. And now in the latest effort, we're trying to look at, can we, from the biomechanical data and the walking distances, understand the accumulation of fatigue? Right. And so we're using fatigue models and fatigue recovery models to try to understand the workload in terms of fatigue and what that might mean for the nurse or for the ultimately for the patient. Right. Because a fatigued nurse is more likely to make errors is more likely to slow down in their work. They just can't keep up. And so it becomes a signal variable of a variety of problems, both for the nurse and for the patient.
How do you factor in the changes in the patient themselves? I'm a nurse by background, so hands-on experience tells me that part of the problem is the design of the task, the environment, et cetera, but part of the problem is the changing nature of patient dependency.
So our models right now are designed to run for a single shift. So we're not tracking changes in the patient state within a single run in the model. But what we can do is between runs, we can change the acuity of a patient by turning up the time per task for acuity sensitive tasks, right? And by changing the frequency, right? So maybe the dressings need to be changed not once a day, but twice a day, right? So that goes into the model. Changing dressings isn't 20 minutes, it's 40 minutes, right? And that's essentially how we handle it. It's that simple. It's crude, but it's effective. And that's the nature of modeling, right? You're not reproducing the workplace that you're modeling. You're trying to understand it at a level that you can act on that has reasonable veracity, but there's always something missing, right? So the accusation that, you know, well, these models don't represent everything I do are completely true. They don't, and they never will, and they're not supposed to. You know, what they're supposed to do is understand how is it that you're given 14 hours of work to do in a 12-hour shift, and what's driving that? And what is it that needs to change? And how do we manage that workload in an appropriate way? But in terms of patient acuity, it's that simple. We turn up the dial on times and we turn up the dial on frequencies for those tasks that are relevant for that particular scenario.
So based on your project so far, what have you found?
We found that nurses have a lot of work to do. They're doing a lot of running around. They're walking 10 kilometers per shift in terms of trying to deliver care. We've done a number of scenario analyses that link workload to missed care, which is a critical care quality variable. So the patient bed assignments are driving missed care. The patient acuity is driving missed care. We did some simulations of care in COVID-19 scenarios. So we had with a 1-to-5 patient ratio, we sort of increased the number of COVID patients from 1 out of 5 to 2 out of 5, 3 out of 5, till they had all 5 patients. And in the scenario, a nurse would have to don and doff their personal protective equipment each time they go into a room. So that adds a task at the start and at the end of every room entry before they could go in and deliver the task. And, you know, when you start to look at those times, even if it's only a minute or two to do that donning and doffing activity, the number of times they do it is outrageous, to the point where with 5 patients, you'd spend half your day, 6 hours a day, donning and doffing PPE. And the pattern with these models is not so much the individual findings that we have in one analysis, because we know that if you add donning and doffing, they're going to spend more time doing it, but that the tool lets you then isolate and quantify this. And that's what management needs to start making smarter decisions, right? We can then say, okay, under these circumstances, you're going to need not one nurse, but you're going to need 2 nurses, or you'll need 1.3 nurses. Now there's a problem. Where do we get a third of a nurse, right? But it changes the discussion. And I think we've had a situation for the past 10 years, here in Canada at least, I suspect elsewhere, nurses have been saying, we're overworked. And management has been saying, just do it. And the union is saying, nurses are overworked. And the government is saying, just do it. And nobody's listening to what the nurses are saying. Now, we can all think of reasons why that might be, right? Female-dominated profession in a lower echelon core of the healthcare system. Why might people not listen, right? So that we have our biases. But what the model does is say, look, here's how it's designed, and here's the results you're going to get. And if you want to change the design, that's fine. But otherwise, what you have is magical thinking, right? You just wishfully think that we can add a new IT system where nurses are going to be typing all kinds of data in for half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour a day, and still get all the rest of their work done. And what the models do is it makes that transparent, right? Here's what this is costing in terms of time. Here's the time utilization patterns. And under these circumstances, it doesn't add up. And if you want to have a discussion, let's talk about what went into the model. It's not our biases. It's not our opinion, right? This is what, when you combine the evidence, when you combine the data in the way that these models let us do, you can start to have an entirely different discussion. And that's where we want to get to with this.
So have you had the chance to have these discussions with the Canadian health system, and what's the outcome been?
We've been having these discussions with managers and senior managers in our healthcare partner agencies. We've been reaching out to the policy level people in the government. But that's a slow game. And so, again, I think we're relatively early days with these models. We're learning to build confidence as to how to build them. We're getting tremendous draw from the health authorities here. The provincial health authorities are interested. Some of our long-term care home organizations are very interested, and we're looking at trying to move into that sector now. So the management layer is all on board. They realize they need tools. They realize they don't have any measures. And if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And that's true in manufacturing. It's true in healthcare. And what we're trying to do is create measures that will allow people to manage it. Have we had a radical change at the policy level? No. Is that going to take years? Yes. Right. And that's the challenge, right? As a researcher, sometimes we have to play the long game. And I think that's the case here, that if we build these models, if we show how useful these models are, we will have an evidence-based basis and objective basis to have a more mature discussion about nurse workload or personal support worker workload in our healthcare system. And try to get away from this magical thinking that somehow the nurse will rise to the occasion, right? And I've never seen a workforce as motivated as nurses. And that's actually a problem, because they'll put the patient first and not themselves. And in the long run, then we run into health problems and burnout. And so we need these objective tools to try to overcome the magical thinking of, oh, they can just do it. They'll find the time somehow, right? And what's happening is they're finding the time by not taking breaks, by not taking lunches, by coming early, by staying late. And that's not a sustainable solution. And I really hope that these tools can then start to change that discussion. And that's our goal.
So what controls can we put in? What has your research highlighted?
Again, this approach is not about creating... The interesting thing to me about the approach is we're not creating solutions. We're trying to create an understanding of the system so that the people in the system can take control and manage it, right? So what we're trying to do now is move to the point where we work with a team over a longer period of time to, they can use this model to test their ideas. What are you thinking about? What do you want to do? So that if you take a participatory approach or a co-design approach, that the model can give that team information about what's driving that workload problem, but also give them a platform to test their idea before they apply the policy and say, well, what would the impact of this be? How much difference would it make? Right. And so we don't come with, it doesn't give us solutions, it gives us knowledge. And that's the difference, right? And some people find that unsatisfying, right? They want us to say, give us the solution, give us the fix. And my response, both in healthcare and in manufacturing, is, where's your fix-it team? Who built this mistake, right? And what do they need? Who's going to fix this mistake? What do they need to make better decisions? What support do they need to justify and understand the solution concepts that they're generating, right? And so we're trying to build the capacity of the organization, not simply give them a fix, right? And that's the long game. Sometimes they don't like that. People want the fix, right? They want the quick fix. But if you do that, they don't learn. And so this is for me as a researcher at the research layer, this is the long game that we're trying to play, is to develop tools, methods, approaches that help people design better workplaces, both in the short term, but also in the future for the next generation and the next generation of workplace.
Okay. I'm just thinking about that. I think I'm personally probably someone who's always looking for a control. And as an ergonomist, I'm always trying to find a control for somebody. And I note that in the research that you'd published in July this year in the Ergonomics International Journal, looked at simulation. You'd actually come up with some interesting things in there, and some of the things that you raised were that where the geographical location of the bed is different, that the cumulative load to the lumbar spine is less. Can we talk about that for a sec?
Yeah, okay. That was an interesting finding. And in fact, it also showed that if you had more COVID patients, you had less spinal loading. And the reason for that is that walking around between rooms is not a heavy load task, right? Changing your gown and your mask and your gloves is not a heavy load task. So if you rearrange your work, so you spend all your time walking because you have long hallways and you're at opposite sides of the hallways, and you spend all your time, you spend hours changing your PPE, you're not delivering care. And it's those care tasks that are the heavy load tasks. And so that's why when you substitute a heavier task of actually delivering care with a lower task of walking around or changing PPE, your total load comes down. The peak load stays the same. Your single instant load, biomechanical load on spine or shoulder will be the same. But these cumulative loads over the day actually start to come down, which was counterintuitive to us. We were sure that was a serious workload problem, and it is, but it's not a biomechanics problem, right? It leans way more heavily into the job demands, job control problems of psychosocial factors. And those are not to be sneezed at. And I think the interesting thing with these models is they're very quantitative, but you start to tap into some of these psychosocial dimensions as well, in terms of what are the demands on the person? How many tasks does a nurse have to keep in mind, right? Do they have 45 tasks in their head that they have to remember which patient needs what, right? These mental demands and the pressure of not having delivered that care is crushing. And the model reveals that. So this is kind of one of the interesting dimensions of how the models reveal unexpected effects that we hadn't maybe thought about, but also how they can span domains. They have implications for physical workload, for psychological demands, for fatigue accumulation, and also for patient care quality. Right? If a patient has to presses a button because they need some help, how long does it take before a nurse can actually free herself or himself from their care tasks in order to go and attend to that? And that wait time, then that a task wait time, how long does a task wait until it gets performed, right? That's an interesting indicator, right, that you can use to look at what's the quality of the system as designed in this model, right? And then what can we change in this model that might make that indicator bring it to a better state.
So quality of care, being a nurse, I would have always thought was staff to patient ratio. So more staff is a better option. Is that what your studies have found?
Well, I mean, ultimately it is, right? But how much staff? How many hours, right? What kind of staff ratio? And what patient? What's the acuity of the patient? How stable are they? How often do we have to check them? Where are they lying? Are they, you know, are the rooms all together or the rooms fall apart, right? There's all kinds of elements there that determine, that contribute to the workload of the nurse and the way they're able to use their time to care for patients. And so nurse-patient ratio is, I'll call it a marker of workload, but there's a big difference. If you have five patients in an ICU, you're in big trouble. If you have five patients in an acute care ward, that might be perfectly fine, right? So the nurse-patient ratio is a really, really weak and crude indicator. And I think we really need to move past that. And that's, I think, the barrier that we're trying to break through with these kinds of models is to say, look, nurse-patient ratio is not a workload indicator, right? It's a staff assignment indicator. It has implications for workload, but there's way more to it than that.
So how do we use this research when every department in a hospital is different and that hospitals function by just allocating the same number of nurses to various wards where the load is different?
Yeah. I think you've just put your finger right on the research front that we're operating at now. That's exactly the question we're trying to figure out. Okay, we can build these models. And look, they're coming. People are coming. They're interested, right? But we haven't fully figured out how do we utilize these models within the healthcare system, I think certainly, and we're working on building some connections. We'd like to work with architectural teams that are doing design of the building, right? And how does that layout of the building start to affect the ability to deliver work, to deliver healthcare in an efficient way? But there's a lot of other potential uses for it. And this is what we need to try to figure out. Once we have a library of tasks for a certain kind of work, let's say acute care for post-operative patients, we think we can apply that relatively quickly to other acute care units that have similar care demands. All we'd have to change would be the geography and the patient assignment, right? But there's still this question of who's going to use the tool, who's going to program the tool, and how do we make that work? And this is exactly the research we're trying to propose right now, right? Is how do we get the tool used? And this is a classic problem in ergonomics research. Whether you're designing a Rula tool or an Okra tool or a NIOSH equation, we build these tools, right? But who's supposed to use them and when? And in what process? And who's recording it? And who's asking for the information? And who's checking that it was done? And how do you demonstrate continuous improvement, right? All of these are wonderful questions that we sometimes don't answer because we're so happy that we got a tool that works, right? We have a checklist. We have a little software piece. So now that we're able to build these models, and they're still pretty expensive, we're trying to find ways to do it cheaper, but that's part of the game. Right. We're really starting to move into more active, I won't call it intervention research, maybe I'll call it action research, in which we work with the organization to say, okay, how do you want to use this information? Who needs to know what to make the right decisions in the development process? Who needs to understand this at the policy level? How do we know, you know, at the organization level, how many nurses do we need? Or at the division level, how many nurses do we need? And I think these tools can help with that. So they're decision support tools, but we need to find the decision maker. And that then is another problem, because in our healthcare system, the decisions are stratified all the way through the system, starting with national policy. Here, it then goes to provincial policy, and the provinces each run their own healthcare system. So it's a horrendous patchwork. And then the institutions, the hospitals themselves, have their own management structures. The healthcare building designers, the architects and the teams that are building them, make their own decisions. And then the poor managers and charge nurses who are doing assignments and managing operations have to try to make the whole thing run. And so all the way through this hierarchy, you have decisions being made that influence the front line. And you have to reach into that hierarchy to make that work. And we've seen this in some of our past work in manufacturing. And actually, it's very, very similar problem between manufacturing and healthcare in that sense. Once you're at the organizational design and management level, you have very, very similar problems. It's just the work itself that's so very different. So this question of application, I think, is a really, really important one that you're asking, and one that I think needs a lot more research. And that's what we are hoping to get funding to pursue.
Wow, there's a huge job ahead of you, I think.
That's the challenge. I think, you know, don't be afraid of big challenges. They start with a step. Everything moves us forwards. You know, when we've moved the bar as far as we can, someone else will come along and take it further. You just have to take that first step and keep moving towards that North Star. And eventually you'll make progress.
It would be an entirely different podcast on its own, but you've mentioned moving into aged care. We call it aged care in Australia here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Given that there are more consistency in the way the tasks are done and the level of dependency or as you put it, patient acuity,
yeah.
I'm wondering whether modelling those areas would give you more information, or what are your thoughts?
We're experiencing that now. We're running a project in continuing complex care settings. So these are hospitals where the patients are so sick, they need hospital-grade care. Maybe they're immobile, they need constant support. So they can't go to a long-term care center, but they're stable. They're not acute care. They're not getting better. They're not leaving. And so we are indeed seeing this pattern that the work is a little bit more routine, and it follows a more of a daily pattern. And that is proving to be a little bit easier for us because with less variability, you need a bit less measurement, and it becomes easier to get a grip on what the nature of the job is. So we're just now starting to experience that as we look at personal support worker or healthcare aides. The language seems to change in different places, and try to create models of their work and understand how their time is being used. As we speak, we're in discussions with long-term care homes trying to launch projects in that area as well. So I think we'll know a lot more in a couple of years' time on exactly those issues.
These projects are really interesting, Patrick, and I thank you so much for your time today. And I am really excited that you are going to be one of the keynote speakers for our society's conference in November this year in Adelaide, South Australia. Just wonder what you might be sharing with us.
Well, actually, that talk's going to cover a lot more issues related to value and value creation and human factors. So I won't spend too much time on this healthcare stream. Maybe we can have another conversation on that. I'll definitely be touching on the use of simulation tools. But I've been working a lot in this area of the strategic value of human factors in ergonomics. And how is it that ergonomics can contribute to the goals of the organization in a larger frame? And when we start to look at it in manufacturing, this becomes a little easier to talk about in manufacturing because the idea of value in healthcare is complex. So I'll sidestep that for this discussion right here. But when we start to look at what creates value in these organizations, the quality agenda seems to really be a huge, huge area. And we've done a lot of work in linking quality to human factors. And we see that in a lot of interventions, the quality benefits are much, much greater, financially speaking, are much, much greater than the health and safety benefits. But the risk factors are often the same, right? The same things that lead you to fatigue and error making lead to injury. And in the Canadian context, we've had problems where ergonomists are brought in because of the injury problem, but they're stuck then in the injury box. They're working with human resources. They're working with retrofitting systems, but they're not seen as contributing to quality and productivity aspects. And so what I want to try to point out and what I want to try to share with people is some ideas around how to think about human factors as an essential element of all kinds of decision-making in organizations. And that it's your people that are going to help you reach your goals, not your technology. And that if your people aren't able to do the job for whatever poor human factors you've designed, you're going to get poor results. And so the key word there is phantom profits. And phantom profits are what you get when you think you're going to make a whack of money in your new production system, but you've done a bad job with the human factors. And so your productivity is lower, your error rates are higher, your yield is lower, your staff turnover is higher, the quality of people you attract is lower. So the quality of work that you get and the performance that you get is lower. And your anticipated profits vanish. They erode from all of these other factors. And that gap we refer to as phantom profits. And what the human factors professional can do is help the organization avoid the pitfall of phantom profits and make sure that the systems work as anticipated. They're humanly sustainable. People can do good work. They make fewer errors. The yield is higher, the customer is happier. These are the things that I want to try to talk a bit about with folks at the conference.
If you want to hear more from Dr. Patrick Newman, registrations are open for the HFESA conference now. You can join us face-to-face or via our hybrid platform at ergonomics.org.au. I personally look forward to meeting you there. Thanks for joining us at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Hub, brought to you by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia, where human-centred design really matters. If you like this podcast, make us your favourite in your podcast app. We look forward to chatting with you next time.